chance to be able to hear oral arguments. So thank you very much.
Well, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our oral calendar today. I think you'll find both of them interesting. And if you want to stick around or have time to stick around after oral argument, we would be happy to talk with you. So, okay, with that, our first matter is A22-0848 in the matter of the CSRS appeal by Professional PCA Services. And I know that you both are experienced advocates. You know that you have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please state your name for the record. The proceedings are being recorded and will be posted on our website shortly. So with that, Attorney for Relator, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
And I should also say there are three podiums. You can either choose the one in the middle, which goes up and down, or the one by your desk.
I'll choose the one with the timer.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Kennedy. I represent Professional PCA LLC, also known as PPS for these proceedings. I'll start with the chronology just because that's useful to everybody, including the students behind me. Under Ahmed Noor's ownership, PPS provided PCA services before May 2016, and that's the focal point of these allegations. There's no contention that the services were not actually provided, no contention that they weren't sufficiently and adequately provided. The only contention that arose later was that they weren't documented well with care plans and timesheets that met the requirements. On May 16th, 2016, there was a purchase agreement whereby Mr. Noor agreed to sell PPS to Abdirazak Abdullah. That transaction, according to the purchase agreement itself, would take place when DHS approved a new enrollment for PCA services in the Minnesota healthcare programs. So an application was submitted. There is no allegation that any services after May 16th, 2016 were inadequate or were not adequately documented. So it's everything that's at issue is before this transaction. There were inspections by DHS on November 16th, 2017 and July 9th, 2018, resulting in a notice of overpayment on March 11th, 2020, and that was amended a few months later, alleging that $600,000 had been overpaid to this agency. There were notices of appeal for those notices of overpayment, and in those notices of appeal, the PPS took the position that we're only appealing if the appeal or this overpayment would affect us as a new provider, because we are a new provider, and DHS processed the application it went in. So DHS took the position that it does affect the new provider. The notices themselves were sent to the new provider, to Abdirazak Abdullah, not to Ahmed Noor. And it's, again, it's not alleged that Abdirazak Abdullah did anything wrong during his time at the agency.
And by that you mean that they use the new provider number. I mean, the notices themselves were sent to the LLC, correct?
The notices were sent to the LLC with Mr. Abdullah's name on them. So they were sent to Mr. Abdullah, not to Mr. Noor. The NPI on there, the National Provider Identifier on there, was the old one under Mr. Noor. And so Mr. Abdullah said, I'm only objecting, or I'm only appealing if this affects my enrollment, which is not an NPI at all. It's a UMPI or UMPI, which is a different provider identifier.
How do you respond to the decision of the ALJ and the commissioner and the now the respondent's argument that, you know, under it's Minnesota's, you know, LLC law that should apply, and here, you know, the agency is pursuing this claim against the LLC, which is separate and apart from who actually owns the LLC under Minnesota law?
Yeah, so DHS had its choice of how they wanted to seek money back. They could have pursued a civil lawsuit. They could have pursued a criminal proceeding with restitution claim. They chose an administrative procedure, which is allowed by and bound by administrative laws as to who they can seek compensation from. And those laws state quite clearly that you can seek restitution or you can seek reimbursement from the provider that received the money. And so then you get into who received the money and how do you define what is a provider? And so the briefs address those issues. Who received the money was clearly the old NPI under Mr. Neuer's ownership. And it's not disputed at all that the new provider has different ownership, different federal tax ID number, and different provider identifier.
But it's the same LLC.
It's the same LLC.
Why isn't the LLC the provider then?
Because the statutes define what is a provider. They state specifically that a provider is somebody with the same tax same federal tax ID. And so by choosing that this proceeding, the other rules that may apply in a criminal or civil context are not as applicable as the specific rules that say a provider is somebody with a specific tax ID. And this agency was allowed to get enrolled with a different tax ID. Now, DHS could have said, we're not going to enroll you until you address this overpayment. Remember that there were 3 years between the first inspection and the time that this agency was approved for a new provider status. During that time, DHS could have taken the step of saying, no, we're not going to create a new provider status for you until you address this. But they didn't do that. They allowed Mr. Abdullah to establish a new provider entity under the law because it has a new tax ID number and go forward. And with their doing that, they allowed the creation of a different provider from whom they cannot seek compensation or reimbursement.
I guess my question is, then who could the agency seek compensation from? Because the previous owner no longer owns the LLC, and the money was paid to the LLC. And I guess that's what I'm just struggling with. It's unclear to me that the agency would be able to pursue this claim against the previous provider if the previous provider really is the same LLC. I guess that's what I'm struggling with.
Yeah, and it could be that the DHS has set up a position where they had an agency, a provider, that they could receive, could seek reimbursement from, and they took actions which made it impossible for them to do that. And that action would be allowing this LLC to become a different provider. And they took that action. It wasn't my client that took that action.
But in terms of the, I think it was a provider identifier number, when DHS did finally approve it, they said they would, you know, backdate it to, I believe it was March. But then PPS said, no, we actually want it to not go into effect until December. So why is, it seems like, PPS was getting the benefit of the money that it was receiving, the entity, and yet it's now trying to claim, oh, you know, we shouldn't be liable for that because we changed owners. And isn't really whoever owns it, isn't that really a dispute between them in terms of the agreement between them, that purchase agreement between those parties rather than an issue with DHS?
No, Your Honor. The issues about the dates make no difference. DHS had complete control over what dates they put on
sure
documents.
Well, I'm not sure DHS had complete control because PPS said when DHS told PPS we will backdate it, PPS said, no, we want you to actually not have it go into effect until December. So it seems like PPS did have some control over that in the discussions they had with DHS.
Right, but none of those dates make any difference because this overpayment claim relates back to before 2016. So when the actual notice came out, doesn't make any difference. It's who owned the agency, whether it was a different provider back in 2016, not whether it was a different provider when the actual notice came out. When DHS approved that action, sorry, approved the new provider status, that's what, as Judge Larson pointed out, that's what may affect their right to go after the old agency. It doesn't matter what date they put on the document or when the transition was made. The fact is they made the decision, and the fact that they made the decision is what matters. They could have sent out the notice of overpayment in 2017 or 2018, or 2022. It wouldn't matter because it all relates back to the old provider.
But so under your argument, the ownership doesn't matter. It's when the provider name changed. So you, essentially what you're arguing is that DHS should not have allowed the new owner to be able to change the provider ID in order to still be able to receive compensation from the LLC. I mean, or are you arguing that simply the change in ownership by itself, because I think that we're kind of confusing sort of when the provider name, when the provider number changed and when the purchase agreement was signed, like there does seem to be some fuzzy area there, right?
To be clear, it is the statute that says that when the tax ID number changes, you have a new provider. DHS's position is different from that. It doesn't matter for the purposes of this, but they say when the ownership changes, the tax ID changes, and the provider ID changes, all three of those, then you have a new provider. In this case, all three of those changed anyway, so the distinction doesn't matter. Either one of those say this is a new provider, and when DHS took that action to say, yes, we're going to allow you to be a new provider, they said, we're not going to go after this corporation because it's a new provider. They may have had a claim against Mr. Neuer and the corporation, and they have, in other cases, said, you can't go forward until this is overpayment is addressed.
Is this state number you're talking about the Uniform Minnesota Provider ID or UMPI?
Yeah, UMPI, yes.
Yeah, UMPI. That's what you're talking about.
So you can have an NPI, a national
right,
provider, or
right.
a Uniform Minnesota provider. Either one
have
can be used.
Have the FEIN, too.
Right, that's a separate type of identifier.
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure which number you're referring to.
Yeah, when I say provider ID, I mean that UMPI or NPI.
I have a question, a different question for
yes.
you. My question is, DHS initially said that there were overpayments of some $634,000. It goes to the ALJ. The ALJ says, no, it's $344,000. Goes to the commissioner. The commissioner ups it by about $70,000.
Yes.
Up to $405,000. And so as I read your arguments, I want to make sure that I'm understanding them clearly. You are not contesting the ALJ's finding of the $344,000. You're contesting the commissioner's increasing it by $70,000. And then it's who pays that?
That's mostly correct. We are, as you know, saying there's no liability to this provider.
Right.
But beyond our second argument is if there is a liability, it is in the 300 range, not the 400 range.
Okay.
We're arguing against that additure of almost $80,000.
I wanted to make sure that I was understanding your argument correctly. Thank
yes.
you.
And I have a follow-up question for you, and this goes to the DH form 5550. And for that form, it seems to indicate that if the new owner uses the prior provider identifier, then the new owner accepts that the claims will accrue to the transferee, i.e. the new owner. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that was initially the indication saying we will keep the old NPI. But it became clear that they could not do that because of some DHS rules, so they created a new NPI, a new tax ID number, and a... and, of course, new ownership. So at that point, they had to change that 5550 to say, no, we're choosing a different NPI.
But then you're relying on the tax ID number then, correct? To show a change in owner, to change in the structure of the of PPS then, right?
We are, but in this case, we changed all three. The statute says it's a tax ID number, the federal tax ID number, but we did change all three, and that's the DHS position, that all three have to be changed.
Right, that's but my understanding is DHS's position is all three were not changed. And you can't rely on just, you have to have all three changed, not just one or two.
You can clarify with the respondents' counsel, but I don't think that's their position. I think they acknowledge that the tax ID number, the provider identifier, and the ownership were all changed.
So 256B.064 provides that the commissioner may obtain monetary recovery from a vendor. We've been talking about provider. Do you think that those two nouns are interchangeable?
In this case, yes. A vendor is defined as a provider.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
And how do you want to spend your last 13 seconds?
I have never had time left over. I could go to that second argument in more depth, but my time does not allow it.
I'll ask if either of you have any questions. We'll probably see you on rebuttal then.
I hope so. Thank you.
Might take just a second. Good morning. May it please the court. James Schobrel, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Respondent Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. This appeal presents the question of successor liability of an LLC and a vendor of medical care. There's generally no dispute, as you heard, that the state improperly paid in excess of $330,000 to the relator. The parties instead dispute two issues. First, whether monetary recovery against relator, the LLC, is proper. It is. Under section 256B.064, relator is the vendor that was improperly paid Minnesota Healthcare Program funds. Just as in any other LLC, relator's liabilities and claims adjustments by default stay with the entity, not the individual owners. Minnesota statutes reflect this treatment, and so does DHS policy and practice. Furthermore, relator was effectively operating as the same provider throughout the entire applicable time period. Second issue is whether the commissioner's decision to increase the overpayment amount by about $70,000 was arbitrary and capricious. The commissioner's decision was not arbitrary and capricious because it was based on a careful review of the record and relevant law. It was not counter to the record evidence, and it did not represent the agency's will. This court should therefore affirm on both issues. I want to start with the monetary recovery argument, and then I'll focus on the arbitrary and capricious issue.
Actually, counsel, if you don't mind, I'd actually like to jump to the second issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the reason why is because, and I'll certainly, I'm sure we'll hear from appellant's counsel, relator's counsel, but on the finding by the commissioner, DHS, DHS found that Murden, the person who reviewed the documents on July 19th, they overturned the decision by the recommendation, I should say, from the ALJ, administrative law judge. The commissioner said that Murden's testimony was credible. How could the commissioner find her testimony credible when it didn't hear the testimony? That's what the ALJ heard, not the commissioner. So how can its decision to increase the amount by $70,000 not be arbitrary and capricious when the commissioner can't find that testimony credible?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the first thing to note there is that the ALJ never found, contrary to relator's position, the ALJ never found Ms. Murden not credible.
Is the converse true? Did the ALJ find Murden credible? Murden's testimony credible?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that
where is that in the record?
that the ALJ found her testimony credible. That's not a specific finding that the ALJ makes, but if you review the ALJ's report, the ALJ refers favorably and cites to Ms. Merton's unrebutted testimony throughout and incorporates her testimony as the findings of fact. And it's those same findings of fact and those same testimony, portions of testimony that the commissioner relied on in addition to the commissioner looking at the testimony of Ms. Merton herself. And so I rely on the cases cited in my briefs to find that a commissioner can make credibility determinations and even overrule the credibility determinations of an ALJ. And that's part of the procedure in MAPA that allows that. But in this case, that wasn't even true. Again, the ALJ never found, never made a adverse credibility finding against Ms. Merton. And in fact, her testimony was unrebutted.
I have a general question as well. Why isn't DHS going after the prior owner, which it can do under Minnesota Statute 256B0641 Subdivision 2? It seems like that would be the more logical.
I'm sorry, could you refer that or that statute section that you're?
Sure, 256B.0641 Subdivision 2. Under that subdivision of that statute, DHS could go after the prior owner. I'm curious as to why DHS did not take that route when it appears that all the activities, violations that occurred were under newer, when PPS was under newer's control.
So, Your Honor, Minnesota's Section 256B.0641 Subdivision 2 actually governs recovery of overpayments from entities that are apart from a personal care provider. And so that subdivision, DHS believes, does not apply to this situation because the relator is a provider of professional care assistance services.
But, of course, Mr. Kennedy argues that that there's been only one case where that statutory authority has been affected in a case like this where there's an allegation of abuse. And that subdivision makes current owners liable for overpayments to past owners, but only if the provider is a nursing home, boarding care home, or intermediate care facility for persons with developmental disabilities. And this PCA group wasn't included in that carve-out. How do you respond to that argument?
Your Honor, I would simply say that that subdivision does not apply, but I don't think that that changes the position here. The important thing to note, and Your Honor, it was something you mentioned towards the end of Relator's argument, is there actually is a distinction between vendor and provider, and I'm happy to dive into both of those. And the important thing to note is 256B.064 provides monetary recovery against a vendor of medical care. And Relator here is the vendor of medical care. Excuse me. And the definition for vendor medical care can be found in section 256B.02 subdivision 7. And it's, again, there's no dispute that Relator submitted claims for reimbursement of the medical assistance program and that it furnished medical care services, including home and community-based services and personal care assistance services. There's no dispute in this appeal that PPS, the LLC, is the vendor of the medical care. The overpayments stem from missing care plans that lacked required elements and also improper timesheets. From Relator's argument is correct, from back in 2016-2017 timeframe, but that was the same LLC, that was the same vendor that existed when DHS sought monetary recovery. PPS may dispute that under its current ownership, it was a vendor that was improperly paid, or in other words, that it wasn't the vendor, it's a different vendor now, but the Minnesota LLC law makes clear that the LLC's debts, liabilities accrue to the new owner, or accrue to this, they stay with the LLC, basically. They stay with the vendor despite any changes in ownership.
But DHS does recognize that change in ownership can, in essence, create a new entity with respect to liability issues if certain criteria are met, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And there's two points in the record I'd point you to that. The first is the provider enrollment agreements. And a place to look there, Your Honor, would be document 19, which was Exhibit 100 at the ALJ's hearing. And the page I'm going to cite now is page 17. And this is a standard DHS provider enrollment agreement, and it provides in there the requirements for informing DHS of any changes of ownership of vendors and providers. And that is the specific provision in the provider enrollment agreement that references DHS Form 5550 as well. And so that enrollment agreement specifically notes that the provider or the vendor is agreeing that all claims, payments, or adjustments will be assigned to the new owner without regard to the date of service, and any intent by the seller or purchaser to contrary to this must be addressed in the purchase agreement, and it's the obligation of the purchaser to enforce. And so that specific language in the provider enrollment agreement reflects the general nature of LLC successor liability and puts the onus on the parties to the purchase or the sale to come up with a different arrangement that they'd like, and that different arrangement is to be noted on DHS Form 550, so proper notice can be given to DHS about which entities it can provide payments to.
And so, what are the steps that they need to take, and what are the criteria to show that they're not going to be liable for any past liability issues?
Simply providing notice to DHS on that DHS Form 5550. So
once they provide notice, then they're off the hook for those earlier infractions.
Let me back up. I want to make sure I understand what your question is, Your Honor.
Right. Here's my question: is what steps did PPS need to undertake for DHS to recognize that there's a change in ownership, and PPS is in essence being recognized as a separate entity than the prior PPS for liability purposes?
Sure. So, Your Honor, what could have or should have perhaps happened is the purchase agreement could have more accurately reflected the current owner's position that he wanted to be a separate entity, and that would have been in the purchase agreement, as the provider enrollment agreement reflects, could have put in the purchase agreement the specific terms to ensure that those obligations fall on the seller. DHS should have been notified at least 90 days, I think it's 90 days, in advance of the sale, and and the provider enrollment agreements and the provider a new provider enrollment agreement would have had to have been made prior to the sale, and proper DHS should have been given proper notice of that, so the new provider identifier and the new established entity would be up and running as part of the transfer of the ownership.
What about the opposing counsel mentioned that DHS concedes that they're basically, three criteria looking at: provider ID number, the tax ID number, and notification of a change in ownership. Is that correct?
So DHS agrees that there was a notice of change of ownership. There's no dispute about that.
Okay.
DHS does dispute the provider identifier. And for purposes of this appeal, as I mentioned, for the relevant time period, PPS or the relator continued to use that same provider identifier through and continuing until after DHS issued its notice of overpayment. So it is important in this case, while not dispositive, because again, the statute provides recovery against a vendor of medical care. So we want to be the distinction between those two, if I may for one moment, is the vendor of medical care, as I said, is defined in section 256B.02 subdivision 7. And a provider is not statutorily defined anywhere. So to the extent that relator had argued that a provider is distinguished solely by a tax identifier, I don't believe that authority exists in statute or otherwise. Instead, provider is defined in Minnesota Rules 9505.0175 and 9505.2165. And a provider does include things like a personal care provider. Personal care assistants can even technically be considered a provider. And the distinction is that a provider is essentially a vendor who has completed the Minnesota Healthcare Program's enrollment and has an approved, department-approved provider identifier as a result of that.
And when you're talking about the provider number not staying the same, you're talking about the OMPI.
Yeah, I think at the time, Your Honor, it was an NPI. So, again, the distinction in my briefs, I tried not to make that. I tried to clarify that a little bit because I don't think there's a whole lot of dispute or issue over the whether we're talking NPI or OMPI in this case. But I think it was an NPI that was the Mr. Nur was using, the prior owner was using, and that Mr. Abdullah continued to use until he obtained an approved UMPI from the state.
UMPI or UMPI?
UMPI, Your Honor. So the other thing I want to note too about, so we talked about the we talked about Minnesota LLC law generally. We talked about the definition. We talked about the Minnesota Healthcare Enrollment Agreement and the DHS practice reflected there. I do want to step back and talk about the statutory definition of a vendor again, because I think that is also important. That's a very long definition, Your Honors, but basically towards the end of it, I do believe that there is some language in there that's consistent with the spirit of company successor liability. The definition of vendor does encompass, by statutory definition, the directors and officers and so forth of companies, but it does limit their liability only to those who personally receive a portion of the distributed assets upon liquidation or dissolution. So again, that's kind of a clear indication that while they may be while the directors and officers of a company may be considered a vendor, they're not liable for anything unless the company dissolves or liquidates, or unless they're going to personally receive the benefits of certain money. So the inference to be made there is that the liabilities of a vendor stay with the company or stay with the entity.
But doesn't that really go to the issue of piercing the corporate veil to protect the individuals?
You could say that as well, Your Honor. I don't disagree with that, but I think it's important to note that another inference to be made is simply that it's the entity is the individual, or the in this case the LLC, that the liabilities go to and stay with.
I asked the same question to appellate. I mean, let's say that everything had that the numbers had all been changed and that the LLC was a new provider. What is there anything the state could do under the statute to get this overpayment from the same LLC with the old provider number? Because, I mean, it's not clear to me if the ownership has changed that you can go after the previous owner under the statute if it's the LLC itself that received the money.
So in this case, it's the if we're looking at the LLC under the prior owner and the prior provider identifier number, the provider enrollment agreements, that same section that I referred you all to a moment ago, does include language in there, so contractual language between DHS and the providers, that provides that, as I mentioned, the claims adjustments accrue to the new owner and stay with the entity. However, there is a provision in there that does permit DHS to recover at its discretion from a prior owner. I don't quote
from the
me on
owner individually and not from the.
I don't recall, Your Honor. I apologize. I don't know if it specifically says owner individually or if it refers to collection efforts from companies that have a related provider identifier or related tax identifier. Collection is kind of outside the scope of, I believe, this appeal, but I would note that at some point DHS has a separate collections effort, and if that collection effort's not fruitful, I believe the collection efforts would be referred to the Department of Revenue to handle. I see I'm out of time.
Any more? So bottom line for you is your client is following statutory, is legally able to do what it did. Too bad for Mr. Kennedy's client. His client, if he wants to recover, needs to sue the previous owner.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that is the position in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. I do have one more question.
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the last part you mentioned that DHS in its discretion could go after newer if it wanted to.
I believe that's indicated in the provider agreement, but yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And doesn't the record reflect that Noor's representations that he was unaware of any investigation by DHS show a falsehood on his part that would seem to indicate that DHS should indeed be going after Noor instead?
I would think that would be more of an indication of falsehoods that would arise in any dispute between the parties of the contract. So that might arise to like a fraudulent inducement claim that Mr. Abdullah could bring against Mr. Noor and seek damages or recovery under that. I would again refer that to the DHS could, in its discretion, go after a provider, but I believe that would also support claims from the buyer to the seller.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Kennedy, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I will lower the yes again. Because as I noted, I can't see anyone with it this eye. Thank you. I have 4 points to make. The first is, it is umpy, not umpy. I do a lot of this work. The second is, on the form 5550, the first option is to keep the same NPI. And if you check that box, then the two through seven below apply. And number seven is that DHS retains the right to pursue monetary recovery or civil or criminal actions against the transferor. So had that box been checked, DHS would retain that. If you check that you will not keep the NPI, then it says specifically that items 2 through 7 do not apply. And that's the DHS form. Third point is it does not matter whether Mr. Abdullah may have insurance or may have a claim against Mr. Noor. The question here is whether PPS is liable under the existing statutes. It doesn't matter whether he can get reimbursement from somewhere else. Last, I want to turn to credibility. As was noted, there is no finding in the ALJ's order that Ms. Merdan was credible. And so it's something that...
Don't you think it's implied?
No, I don't. Because in every case that was cited where... the ALJ's findings aligned with her testimony, it was because there were documents. There were documents that supported that testimony. In fact, it was the documents that the court could rely on regardless of whether Ms. Merdan testified at all.
But isn't the issue of credibility really irrelevant here? Because really what the issue is whether or not there was foundation. In other words, whether or not there's substantial evidence to support the commissioner's view that those documents did have foundational support. Because the ALJ rejected all the documents that Merdan had not reviewed personally, but in the first inspection, but did acknowledge that the ones in the second inspection, she was there. So she could personally testify to what she did, what she saw and the comparisons that she made. And the commissioner affirmed that. So isn't it really more an issue of whether or not there's sufficient support in the record to support the commissioner's determination on that issue?
Well, in the case of this $80,000 almost, all there was the testimony because the documents were not in the record. So for that, you can't say that there was documentary support or record support. All we had
There was in the sense that, I mean, there is obviously that issue of the documents not being turned over, and the system had the documents had been corrupted, but the ALJ did allow a summary to be provided, and testimony as to what the summary of what the underlying documents showed. So there is evidence in the record for the commissioner to say yes, there's enough there to support that finding, only for the $70,000 plus. In fines for the documents from the July 19, 2020 inspection, but not for the prior inspection.
The specific issue about that $80,000 was that Ms. Merdan testified that records did not exist, care plans specifically. And in order to evaluate whether that is true, one would have to look at what was provided to see whether any of those documents constituted a care plan, whether it was labeled as a care plan or not.
Right, but then you're getting into having to prove a negative. And that's why you have to rely on the testimony when she said there weren't any there. How can you prove none existed by providing documents of non-existent care plans?
You can prove it because DHS has the documents and could have and should have provided them to PPS to evaluate and be able to knowledgeably cross-examine her as to whether this document in particular constitutes a care plan that she said did not exist, and would allow the ALJ to look at those same documents and say, yes, it's either positive, a care plan exists, or a negative, a care plan does not exist. It's because DHS took steps that did not permit PPS or the ALJ to go undertake that exercise to be able to prove the negative or understand when Ms. Murdan said there was a negative, that the ALJ did not accept her testimony because those documents should have been there. It's like the CIVJIG, I think it's 12.35, that says if you should have documents and you don't present them, the court can find that those documents, had they been presented, would not be in your favor. And DHS, in this case, had documents and did not present them through its own fault. And so the ALJ rightfully said, no, I'm not going to assume that your testimony as to the negative is correct because you could have proven the negative and you chose not to. My time is up again.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your briefing and your arguments. Well done, and we will have our opinion out within the 90 days.